From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Mark Landis was hoping to stay under the radar with his decades-long enterprise of copying artworks and giving them to museums, but now the cat's out of the bag. There have been a number of articles exploring and profiling this odd, fragile man in Laurel, Mississippi, who passed forgeries to dozens of museums all around the country. Now there's a new documentary film that gives a humane and complex portrait of Landis, and also the man who's been pursuing it. Today in the program, we're profiling that film. It's the latest in our documentary series, Through the Lens. We're screening the film next week. Today, the filmmakers Sam Coleman and Jennifer Grousman will join us to talk about Landis's motives and the nature of his deception. Join us after the news. Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are continuing our documentary series called Through the Lens. We're talking about an intriguing film today that is going to leave you wondering just how to feel. You'll get a chance to see it next week. We're going to be screening it, and we'll get to those details as we go. It's the story of Mark Landis. He is a wisp of a man, small and fragile, but really gentle, and he also happens to be an art forger. At least that's the initial impression. He copies works of art, and then he goes around the country, or did anyway, giving this art to museums, dozens of them around the country. Of course, he doesn't tell them they're fakes. But the film is not an exposé, not really. It's a deeply personal portrait of this art forger and the man who pursues him. The film is called Art and Craft, and the filmmakers today in the program are joining us to talk about it. We invite you to join the conversation as well. You can call 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Jennifer Grousman and Sam Coleman directed and produced the film. Sam also co-directed, shot, and produced the film If a Tree Falls. He was a producer of the documentary The House I Live In, which won the Grand Jury Prize at the 2012 Sundance Film Festival. Jennifer's production credits include the Emmy Award-winning documentary Pressure Cooker and the film Three Backyards. And they're joining us today from a studio in New York City. And Jennifer Grousman and Sam Coleman, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Well, I guess we should start with the obvious question of when you first heard the story of Mark Landis. Like, when was the first moment you heard about this story?
I read an article in the New York Times in the art section in January of 2011, and it was one of those articles that I read and I cut out and I put away and I sort of couldn't stop thinking about for a couple of days. A couple weeks later, I thought maybe it's worth investigating. And so I got in touch with Matthew Leininger, who was quoted extensively in the article, and spoke to him. And he sounded like a fascinating character. So I showed the article to Sam and our co-director and editor, Mark Becker. And we all felt there was a story to be told. So Sam and I went to film with Matt in March of 2011. And it was sort of during that first visit that we realized we really had to get in touch with Mark Landis. And once we did that and shot with him in May of 2011, you know, we knew there was a movie there.
When you were talking to Matt at first, Matthew Leininger, what was the thing that made you think we've got a film here? Was it more than the story, I guess, the fact that they had these really compelling characters, I guess, too?
Yeah, I mean, I think Matt was a great introduction. And, you know, when you're so new and fresh to a subject, you don't really know where it's heading. And interestingly, the Times article, you know, it painted Mark the forger as at large. Essentially, they said they repeated attempts to find him and contact him had come up short. And so they painted him as this, like, sort of big bad guy on the run. And we didn't even know that it was possible to find Mark. Right. And so the initial instinct was, well, let's talk to Matt. And Matt was great, but you know, with that kind of a tease, that finding Mark was really going to complete the story, and to have, you know, the guy who did it and the guy who's chasing him was going to be the key.
What was your impression of Mark Landis, not before you met him? Just from, because there were a number of articles that talked about him, and I'm sure you got the sense that he was eccentric or a little bit odd, but I wonder what you made of the impression of Mark Landis that you read in those articles.
I mean, I think we were just intrigued, really. I mean, you know, what kind of art forger gives away his works instead of selling them? You know, we'd never heard anything like that before. And just sort of the descriptions of him and sort of the length of his spree, you know, were all fascinating, that he hadn't really been discovered for so long. And then I think, you know, that he sort of lived in Mississippi, and there were other sort of details that seemed very filmic, actually, in a way. So we just were very curious to meet him.
But in terms of first impressions, I mean, I will say this, which I think is sort of laughable at this point, now that I know Mark well, and we understand him in ways that we certainly didn't on first impressions.
Yeah.
But the first time I met him, I was kind of terrified, only because he had this intense stare. He would like one of those people who will lock a gaze with you and kind of raise the hair on the back of your neck. And at that time, you know, the context for us was that we were, as Jen said, sort of looking for his motivations, and we didn't really understand what he was about. And so we were sort of hanging on every word for clues. And you know, with an intense stare like that, it was incredibly intimidating. Of course, that's not the Mark we know today.
Right. Well, but see, I think this is the thing that's so, I have to say, great about the film, is because the impression you get in some of the profiles or some of the articles, they're more kind of expose, and they're sort of uncovering this kind of malicious character, and that's not the Mark Landis that comes off in the film. And you keep looking for clues. I have to say, as an observer, when you're watching the film, there are times when you're convinced he's just completely pure. And then there are other moments when you think that he is kind of not that he's kind of fooling you. And like, there's one moment, for example, when he mentions how the people at this clinic that he had gone to, because he had had some mental health issues early in his life, they said that he was a bright little boy, you know, and he was proud of that. They said, "I'm a bright little boy, but inclined to be mischievous." And he seemed to kind of take some pleasure in that. And I thought, oh, maybe there's a clue that he does know what he's doing. Will you talk a little bit about that? Because that is what's so complicated, and I have to say great about the film, is he is really, really complex.
Yeah, it's – I don't know. I mean, I think you kind of hit it on the head. I mean, it is true. Mark, what is so remarkable about him in the end is that there is no malice. You know, we thought, as did I think the New York Times and everybody else, that like either this guy has got some political art axe to grind, he's mad at the art markets, mm-hmm. he's mad at the way that the art world works, or he is a frustrated artist who's, you know, mad at having been rejected in his career, or, you know, was he trying to be some kind of a Robin Hood? And all those things are sort of like malicious and heady. And I think Mark, for him, it really wasn't about that stuff. And without spoiling the film, it is sort of something you investigate along the way. But, you know, I think even to this day, we know that there is no malice, but certainly there is mischief. And I think Mark sort of is in between those two poles.
I think you one of you wrote in a blog that I had read about the film that in some ways, in his life, Landis is a character in his own personal movie. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about that, because it seems like in many ways his sense of art, you know, his interpersonal relationships, his even bigger sense of the world seems to all have come from movies, you know, from TV.
That's very true. You know, Mark is, he watches a lot of old movies. He watches old TV shows. He's a little bit obsessed with it. He certainly, you know, I went to film school, and as we were making the movie, he was constantly berating me for 1930s movies that I hadn't seen. And he remembers them all. You know, his memory is incredible. And I think really, you know, a lot of how he interacts with the world is through movies and what he's learned in movies and certainly, you know, that was the inspiration we all had for incorporating film clips throughout Art and Craft and trying to really bring you into Mark Landis's world. But, you know, he just recently met some people on the festival circuit and had an hour-long conversation about Get Smart. You know, he just... It's one of his main sort of hobbies and things that he does. And I think, you know, for us, that was a really rich territory, the sort of meta aspect to delve into in the film.
I want to play a clip that's going to require a bit of a setup, but there's this moment where he is talking about how the only reason he knows anything about Picasso and about Picasso's Blue Period comes from this film, Gambit. And I want to play this section of the film because you'll hear a little bit of from the film itself, Gambit. But you talk about this scene because this is really revealing about, again, a good part of what he knows about Picasso came from a movie.
The symbolic fantasy.
The only reason I would have known about Picasso and his Blue Period would have been because I saw Gambit. She was just showing off her knowledge.
Picasso, and one of his best, I always think.
Oh, the Blue Period.
The kids that I'd have been in class with, when they daydreamed, they'd think, gee, wouldn't it be cool to be like those artists in movies? But I always liked the stuffy rich art collectors.
They must be worth thousands. Hundreds of thousands.
Yes.
The patrons, those are the people I used to daydream about.
Talk a little bit about that scene, if you would.
Well, you picked a good one. I mean, it's also hats off to Mark Becker, our co-director and editor, for putting that one together. You know, Mark has so many references. Mark, our forger, has so many references, as we just talked about with film. And this one was just such a perfect direct line because the scene that precedes it is another reveal that uses Mark, or that takes place during Mark's copying of a Picasso painting. So it's sort of like a direct connection. You know, the film is set up, as we touched upon a little earlier on, to sort of maybe introduce you to Mark as we had been introduced, as this big, you know, bad forger on the run with, you know, all the sort of baggage that we bring into that kind of a label, and slowly peel away that conception. And this particular clip that you selected is, you know, kind of right in the meat of the movie when Mark is sort of has bared a lot, not just his soul, but his process. And in this particular instance, the sort of surprise, which to us was quite shocking, was that it actually wasn't about the painting or the sort of love of making the fake or the love of passing off the fake. It was the attempting to be the stuffy old collector or the philanthropist, which was the second part of what he does. He, you know, he's forger and he's philanthropist, phony philanthropist, I suppose.
Yeah. You don't ever know exactly what it is that's motivating him in some way. I mean, the craft part, as you say, is interesting, but it's this fantasy that he has about being this person who people will like because he's giving you this artwork. I mean, I guess there's some of that in there as well, do you think?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, Mark's motivations are complicated and we try to get at them through the movie, but we spent, you know, time constructing it in a way that we don't want to tell anyone what to think. And I think different people get different things out of the movie. And certainly I think Mark has different motivations on different days, but ultimately, you know, there are some pretty universal things that he wants, whether it's, you know, love or respect or, you know, things that everybody sort of craves in their life.
Let me play another clip, which I think gets at this as well. It's this moment where he talks about, 'cause this question is, as always present, at least for me, it was, at what point is he performing and at what point is he real? I mean, there were moments when he talks about his mother or when he seems to have dropped his guard. And I'm like, oh, that's the real Mark Landis. And then there are moments when you're not really sure. Here's a moment where he's sort of talking about, I guess, the performance part of his life.
When you're doing it or something, you kind of believe it while you're giving things away. You believe it while it's going on, you know. Like a part, like those guys on that are really good at it, you know, good actors, you know, those ones. Not that I think of it as being an actor, but in any event, I just wasn't really used to having anybody treat me like that. Actually, I wasn't used to it all. Used to. I mean, it seldom happened. Let's put it like that. Seldom happened that people were nice to me.
It's interesting. This is another bit of the motivation, I think, that seems to drive him is, and we can talk about this a little bit more later in the program, but this is his childhood and his upbringing. This clearly is a big influence on the person that he became. Do you want to say something about that?
I mean, I think certainly his childhood did, you know, Mark talks a lot about, you know, in glowing terms, really, about his parents, particularly his mother. But the picture that he paints is not one, there's sort of a disconnect. It's not mm-hmm. one that often one would ascribe to having good memories about. He spent a lot of time alone. He's an only child. His father was in the Navy. He spent much of his childhood traveling, and his parents enjoyed themselves. They went out a lot and would leave him often alone in hotel rooms, and that was kind of the genesis of him discovering that he was he was facile with making, you know, representational art. He would copy catalogs from museums that he had visited with his father, you know, during the daytimes, and at night he'd just stay up copying pictures. And I think Mark gained a tremendous amount of self-assurance from that. Mm-hmm. And it was something that I think he was always kind of returning to, is trying to, you know, to recapture that.
The word I kept thinking of is, in some ways, you're kind of embedded with him. You embedded yourselves with him in some levels with the apartment, and you get this sense that I mean, you know, you're there in the ordinary moments when he's, you know, popping open a microwave meal and eating it, and when he's sort of wandering around. And I wondered, what was the challenge of that like? At what point did you get a sense that he did let his guard down as you just sort of sat with him? When I imagine in some ways that's, you had to do some of that anyway. Or did he always seem on, or were there moments when you thought he had dropped his guard? I mean, what was that like, kind of embedding yourselves with him?
I mean, I think for us it was sort of an up and down process. The first shoot, Mark was very sort of candid and open about a lot of things. You know, some of the best shooting we did while he was making copies were also like some of the best sort of offhanded interview moments that we got in the film. And then certainly, you know, there were times we went down where his health maybe wasn't as good and he was a little low energy. Sometimes he was more guarded than others, but, you know, he talks about it took him about a year, I think, to really, you know, warm up to us in a certain way where he felt comfortable being more intimate with us. And so I think, you know, it's interesting to sort of look back and see what that process was. But certainly, you know, we went and filmed a lot and we spent a lot of time with him on the phone, sort of getting to know him over the 3 years that we were making the film.
I think maybe part of the change was, like, you know, it's this thing that happens when, as filmmakers, you walk into someone's life and you have this anxiety of, like, oh, my God, I have to know everything right now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we fired a lot of questions his way and you know, had a lot of anxiousness to, like, understand where he was at those first few shoots. But over time, when our agenda became less, you know, pressing, and Mark himself could kind of take over. And he sort of saw that space and went with it.
There were moments when some of the best part of the film is when you're kind of in on the act, I have to say. and I wondered kind of what were the boundaries for you? I mean, how did you treat the scenes when you accompany him at these? And one of the most extraordinary scenes like I've almost ever seen is when he dresses up like a priest. And he – I don't want to give too much away, but he goes out because this is part of the getup that he has for one of these schemes to give art away, is he's going to be a priest, and he dresses up and you're there with him when he goes and even blesses a guy in one scene, which is kind of shocking and really remarkable. And so I wanted to know how you were dealing with all of that, being there when he's being, you know, deceiving people in some ways, and what you do with that.
Right. I mean, certainly it's a gray area and it's uncomfortable, and it's not something we, you know, basically you see the only two moments of it in the film. We didn't need to shoot much more than that.
The only two moments that we filmed.
Right, exactly. Right. Sorry. Right.
There were other moments.
That we were not there for. And, you know, we just sort of, you know, there was no real planning involved. We sort of knew Mark was going on these sprees, and we came down to visit, and he sort of had these plans he hadn't told us about ahead of time, and we just sort of followed him as he did that. And I think Sam can talk a little bit more about the shooting, but one thing that you spoke of earlier was about Mark really playing roles. Mm-hmm. And I think you see it in the film when he's on that very first phone call and in the very first scene, this type of, you know, persona he puts on, which is quite different when he's just sort of talking to us and to the camera. And so that was something that was pretty interesting for us to capture.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was, it's a unique kind of documentary situation where you kind of hope and pray that you can catch something as it happens, because mm-hmm. even though that's what documentary is about, like, the truth of the matter is we live in a society where people know about cameras and they know about the law. And, you know, most of the films that you see have some sort of a behind the scenes construction to them. That doesn't mean that they're not capturing, you know, truth, but, you know, in order to get someone's permission to film with them, oftentimes documentary producers and directors will make a call beforehand and talk a little bit about what the film is about and agree to, you know, what kind of set of issues or ideas we'll discuss, or at least go over them and get someone's permission, essentially. And in this circumstance, that was not an option, because it would spoil the whole absurdity of the moment, and watching it spoil our ability as filmmakers, but really the ability of the audience to watch Mark perpetrate this act and how people will respond to him. And that was the most important thing. So, you know, as Jen said, that day we showed up. That's what Mark had on the agenda. And so we follow him to these two visits. And, I think it speaks a lot to Mark's magician-like qualities, and he talks about the work that he does as this sort of, you know, phony philanthropist, as a magic trick, and even about the making of his copies as a kind of a magic trick. And I say that because, you know, I am following Mark as a cameraman behind him, you know, 20, 30 feet maybe, to give some distance, but enough to be able to capture the scene. And the people that he's there to visit are so taken by him that they've forgotten about this guy with a with a camera and a big microphone and all the rest of it. You know, even in the raw footage, you can see them locking eyes with the camera, so they know that I'm there. It wasn't as though I completely had hidden myself. They knew I was there. But Mark was so sort of engrossing that their focus had shifted.
Yeah,
I thought that was quite interesting.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. The question of him being a priest or wanting to dress up like a priest, I did want to ask you this before we head to a break. And he talks about, there's this moment in the film when he's reflecting on being a priest sort of as a disguise. And he mentions, you know, I think I'd be a good priest, but I couldn't go into one of those places and, you know, to one of those seminaries and, you know, and do the hard work, is kind of what he was saying. You know, and he says, you can learn everything you want on this DVD series, the Father Brown DVD series. And I wonder if you think that's a kind of a key to part of his character, is that he wasn't really interested in doing the hard work, that he just was interested in the performance.
Yeah. I think that's very, very astute of you to catch that. And, you know, Mark makes copies of things that fit in his briefcase. He doesn't make copies of things that are bigger than he could manage to carry. or managed to have to spend more time to paint, you know. He, when we would film him making copies of things, he would, you know, oftentimes lose interest in the middle of filming, of making a fake. You know, he'd just sort of be like, ah, you get the idea. That's enough, right? And you see him also often, you know, throwing his work around, like literally around the room, because he doesn't have that preciousness about the process. You know, for him, it's a means to an end, to the performance.
And I think he's, you know, he's often talked about his sort of lack of concentration and, you know, attention span and things like that. So I think, you know, when he was talking about 6 years in a seminary, that's something he couldn't fathom. But he also feels like he kind of knows what he needs to be a priest. And he certainly has spoken about giving marital advice and other advice to people he's encountered when he's in his priest outfit.
Amazing. Jennifer Grousman is with us along with Sam Coleman. And together with Mark Becker, they produced, directed the documentary Art and Craft, which we're screening next Wednesday. That's July 9th at 7 o'clock at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. It's an extraordinary film. You really need to join us. It's part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. We have details about that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are continuing our documentary series Through the Lens with an intriguing film. It's called Art and Craft. Jennifer Grousman and Sam Coleman, along with Mark Becker, produced and directed the film. Jennifer and Sam are with us, and you can join us if you like. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We should mention, and I'll give you more details about this a little bit later, but we're screening the film next Wednesday at 7 at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. So the film is about Mark Landis, for sure, but it's also about Matthew Leininger. At what point did you figure that it was about him as well? Because in some ways, it's as much a profile of him, at least on some levels, as it is Mark.
I think, you know, we always knew Matt would be a part of the film. Clearly, you know, it's almost his tracking of Mark that's the active storyline in the beginning. Yeah. And, you know, he talks about sort of dreams of this of putting on this exhibition and of all of Mark's work. And I think once that had sort of come about, we knew we had sort of a full arc to our story, and it became very clear that, you know, it was a two-hander, the sort of cat and mouse story that really, you know, delves into both Matt and Mark's inner lives.
Matt is he's been let go from this museum, maybe, I guess, in part because of this obsession he has with Mark Landis. He's the stay-at-home dad. He kind of grumbles about the fact that being the head of the household and having to stay home. And it's, I have to say, I love these scenes between Matthew and his daughter, where he's kind of, she'll ask these really great questions, almost the questions you guys would probably ask. Like, Dad, are you upset with the people who, you know, fired you from your job before? Or do you think Mark is crazy? Or are you crazy? Or, you know, these really brilliant questions. And he, just his response to them, I have to say, are really telling. I guess you guys feel like you lucked out when you got those scenes, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, there were, some of them were surprises, you know, sort of, you know, catching them after the fact, like, oh yeah, we got that. Because the thing is that, you know, we always knew that there was a interplay between the pursuer and the pursued, but we didn't realize until we started editing, or maybe became close to the process of post, that there was sort of a parallel story between Matt and Mark that we had to tease out, not just, you know, not just the logistics, but sort of a spiritual parallel story.
I want to play another clip just so people can hear Matthew Leininger. He's sort of talking about What he conceives is kind of an obsession that he has with this story.
I don't know if Landis has become an obsession for the general public or the ones at museums. I believe that, I am anal retentive. I haven't been diagnosed with like a, what do they call it now, OCD or ADHD or whatever. But when I get focused on something, I mean, I stick to it and I stay on it until I get to the end of it, you know?
One of the things that does come up, and it's not just a film about how these museums were, you know, these people in these museums were duped, but it does get to, as one director of a museum in Louisiana mentions, their soft spot. The fact that this is about art and it is about money. Talk about that element of this story, if you would.
I mean, I think, you know, Mark has this ability to fool people, and he really never saw it as – he didn't understand, I don't think, you know, why people were so mad at him and why so many people he had duped were upset with what he had done, because in his mind he was actually giving this beautiful picture that they wouldn't have had the opportunity to have. But I think obviously for people in the art world, you know, authenticity is a huge thing, and it's what, you know, a lot of the art world is based on. Certainly, you know, Mark was doing this for 30 years, and you know, sometimes people would figure out right after he left that they were fake. Sometimes it would take 6 months. Sometimes they wouldn't figure it out. You know, there was a whole scope of different outcomes. And you know, part of it is that because Mark was donating them and not taking a tax deduction, you know, they often didn't have to go through the scrutiny that the works would if they were being purchased. And, you know, they might end up in a storeroom somewhere, you know. They're, you know, I think the statistic is 40% of works in museums are actually fakes. Mm. Certainly, you know, forgery's been going on a very long time. So, you know, I think that it really – it depends on the specific situation. But, you know, obviously if something seems too good to be true, it might be.
Right. Were people reluctant to talk to you from museums? The people who felt like, do I really have to talk about the fact that I got duped last year or whatever it was?
Surprisingly not. I mean, we did get some rejections. You know, bigger institutions, most notably. But I think the ones that did talk to us were the ones that were more within Mark's footprint, like closer to where he lived. And I think they were. I think they saw it as an opportunity to sort of get the story straight, to get, you know, their side told. And, you know, I think they walked away previous to this opportunity with a lot of, you know, embarrassment. And I think they expressed that in the film, but I think they wanted to sort of have their say about it as well. Yeah, I think that's what's so interesting about documentary in the end is that, you know, you have willing participants, and most of the time people do want to tell their story.
There is I wanted to talk a little bit about what you see as Mark's gift, I guess is the best way to put it. He has this thing I guess he himself calls it this gimmick for getting things onto papers. He says it's his memory trick, which he describes it as this kind of trick just to but in some ways it is a gift. I want to play a clip here and have you talk about this trick, this kind of copying trick. Here's another moment from the film Art and Craft.
The earliest I remember doing anything like that would have been when I was about 8 or something, in a hotel room copying pictures out of catalogs. You would put the piece of paper up close to the picture you were copying, and then the closer I got, I guess somehow I just ended up putting the piece of paper over the... And even though I couldn't see through the piece of paper, I could flip it back and forth enough to get a likeness. The memory trick's sort of like a magic trick. or an illusion trick or whatever you have, a conjurer's trick. Yeah, it's the same kind of thing. And so you enjoy. You get a little boost, you know.
What does he mean by that, a little boost? He's turned on by the fact that he can do this thing, I guess. Is that what he's saying?
I think that's right. Yeah. It's sort of like, I mean, if it's unfortunate that folks can't see what was happening, but Mark's, you know, he's got the original down on a piece of on a table in front of him, and he's got a piece of paper over the original that he's flipping back and forth, and by memory sort of, and by the speed at which he's flipping the paper back and forth, he's able to retrace the lines of the original drawing. And it when we first saw it, it has this sort of childlike wonder to it. You know, he invented it as a child, and but as someone who watches it, you have this sort of like childlike reaction that, like, I can't believe I'm seeing that in front of me. It's sort of like when you first watch a photo develop in a bath of chemicals. Mm-hmm. You know, like that image emerges out of nothing, is sort of like what you see. And I think, you know, this is a small little boost, as Mark describes it. I think, as we sort of got to earlier in the conversation, I think his bigger boost was about taking that work to the people.
Yeah, there's two parts to it, but it's but it does raise this question. I think this is for me, this was an important question, and it gets at the title, you know, art and craft. So is this art or is this just craft? And how good is he? Because that comes up a lot too. What did you come down on that question? The crucial question of the movie.
Right. You know, I think we both think Mark is very talented on lots of levels. And certainly, you know, his drawing is wonderful. I think, you know, he says himself there's been times over the years where his copies were less good than others. And, you know, he himself doesn't consider himself an artist. So I think that's part of it as well.
But I think that whole question is wrapped up in, like, in so much bigger stuff. I mean, Mark, on the one hand, will consider himself as an artist, but on the other hand, wants to be a great artist, or wants to be considered a, you know, if not a great artist, like a pretty decent one. You know, it vibrates just as, you know, the question of his skill does. I think without a doubt, he probably once had more interest in honing the skill that he has, and without a doubt, he has skills. But it became less important over the years. Mm.
Here's another moment from the film where he's talking about the first drawing he actually gave away, and this was a piece which I found really interesting. It's a Maynard Dixon, at least in he renders this. This drawing of an Indian in a sort of Maynard Dixon way. But as he says in this clip, this is mine. I drew this. I did this. And then he says this thing at the end. Let me play this clip because I think it's interesting. It seems like there was this transition where at first he's all about the art, the drawing, and then he figured, oh, there are machines that can do stuff too. Here's another clip. This is from Art and Craft.
The first picture I remember giving away was a Maynard Dixon drawing of an Indian. And I actually did it. Yeah, I drew it. Not only did I actually draw it, it was my own Indian because I checked out a book on Indians from a library and I drew a picture of an Indian. I used to actually do things before I found out what all you could deal with the machines.
Talk about it. I love that scene because it's like, I don't need to do that much drawing anymore because there's a photocopier. So, I mean, that to me was like, he's really pragmatic about all of this.
Oh, yeah.
He is. Certainly, he often talks about, I don't think it quite made it into the film, but his grandfather had an auto company and he was very into the assembly line mentality. So often he'll do five or six copies of the same painting at a time, primarily so he doesn't waste paint. You know, he likes to be very efficient. And so I think anything he can do to make his process more efficient and sort of keep the time to a minimum, he'll do.
Jennifer Grousman is with us, along with Sam Cullman and Mark Becker, produced and directed the documentary film Art and Craft. You can see it next Wednesday. That's July 9th at 7 o'clock at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. It's part of our Through the Lens film series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. You can get details about all of that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with Jennifer Grousman and Sam Cullman. Along with Mark Becker, they produced and directed the documentary film Art and Craft, which we're going to be screening next Wednesday night at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. You can get details about that on our website. Jennifer and Sam are joining us today from a studio in New York City. So I wanted to ask you about, because we've been playing little clips from of music from the film, talk a little bit about the music, because it's all – it's Stephen Ulrich, I guess, is the composer. But you've talked about how the music, like this big band music of the 40s, it's really – and it's almost like it's another character in the film.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the first time we met Mark, we were soon in his car, which was actually his mother's car, a big red Cadillac. And the first thing that happens when you get on in his car after he turns the ignition is that 40s, 4 on 40s or whatever, the Sirius radio show,
right.
Comes loud and blasting in his car. And it was like it totally sent a chill up our spines because it just like worked so perfectly. You looked at this guy who sort of exists and feels and has all the references and a sensibility of another era, is now driving a Cadillac through, you know, strip mall Mississippi, you know, blasting 40s music, 40s big band music. And it was, it just felt right. And so when we first really started editing, we knew that that music had to inform, you know, the feel of our film and how and what way we weren't sure. And Mark Becker, our editor and co-director, had a lot of great ideas about music that we might play with. And we used a lot of temp music that, you know, 20 some odd cuts of temp music that we fell in love with and forgot about the fact that it would be way too expensive to actually use. And when it came down to business, we realized that it was way too expensive to actually use. So we were actually quite lucky to be in touch with Stephen Ulrich, who did the score for our film, because he transformed what we thought we were in love with to be something even much bigger and more dynamic, I think. Stephen basically used the temp music that had been our guide to then build on something original, and we're grateful.
Well, it makes it seem like such a caper film, too. It gives it that sensibility, which is great.
That's right, yeah. Pushing the sort of noir aspects and the sort of... you know, even like the sort of noir can be very tongue in cheek sometimes too, and that's very much, you know, the feel of our film as well. You know, you're never quite sure where you're supposed to be because Mark is always kind of putting you on your toes, and so the music sort of underscores that feeling as well.
Yeah, it's a perfect contrast, though. You know, hearing that music and seeing this little wispy man wandering around a Hobby Lobby in Mississippi—it's perfect.
I'll never forget, we were in, the last scene of the film took us by surprise, without giving away too much details, we were walking back with Mark from the last scene of the film around town, and we walked past a restaurant that was playing a piece of music that had been in our temp score, that had been like the main title of our temp score.
Wow.
And so we physically watched Mark in real time walk through our score. It was like this crazy meta moment of a movie, but we knew for sure we had it right at that point.
The universe was telling you it was just right. Yeah,
exactly.
Well, there's this the film builds to this moment that we won't spend much time with because I don't want to give much away. There's this exhibition of his work, but those scenes are really, really remarkable. But the big question that does come up among some of the people there who or at the exhibition. And it's the question that people, I'm sure, we're all asking ourselves as we're seeing this. And the question that's put to him is, why not, Mark, why not use these gifts that you have to, as opposed to copying other people's work, why not create your own art? And he has done his own stuff, some of his own stuff for sure. But I wanted you to talk a little bit about that, his sense of, does he find his own work not as mysterious and romantic and interesting? What do you think about that question?
I mean, I think he speaks to it earlier in the film. You know, he went to the Art Institute in Chicago, and he knew how to draw, so he decided to take photography because he would learn something new. And, you know, he learned all the mechanical processes of taking photographs and developing his own work, and then realized he didn't have anything he wanted to take a picture of. And so I think for Mark, you know, art is not so much about the original impulse as it is, you know, the work and copying as some sort of, whether it's comforting or just something he's used to. And certainly, sort of since word got out about Mark, he's made some friends in town and has been doing some commissioned works now, whether it's people's grandchildren or fake Monets signed by Mark Landis. So, you know, I think it's certainly something he's thought about, but every time, you know, we talk to him about it, he doesn't really have sort of the voice of an original artist where he has something he feels like he has to create.
Someone said to me after a screening recently that, which I thought was really profound, part of this discussion, you know, she said that she knew why Mark couldn't do his own work and why it was never of interest to him. And the way she described it was that, you know, as we've talked about, Mark, you know, spent a lifetime living with mental illness and has, you know, sort of lived in isolation in some ways. And all this stuff is wrapped up in, you know, who he is as a person. But she said that she felt that he could never make his original work because he was always accessing the outside world through other people's work. And so to make a copy of that work was his way of participating in the world. Mm.
So you screened the film, I think, and this is probably typical of when you get into a festival, as you're working right up until the first screening time. You screened it at Tribeca. Was that the first time that Mark Landis and or Matthew Leininger saw the film?
It was. We were very nervous. We had asked Mark if he had wanted to see the film before and had offered to show him parts while we were shooting, but he didn't want to see anything. He doesn't like hearing his voice, particularly on film. And so, you know, he was nervous, and he was very happy to come to New York and go to the party, but we weren't sure he was actually going to come and watch the movie. So he said he was going to, and then I think at the last minute sort of had cold feet and was hiding out in the men's room. And luckily, Stephen Ulrich, our composer, found him there and sort of convinced him, well, they didn't have to go see the screening. They could go around the corner to a bar, have a drink, a chat. And then somehow Stephen got him back into the theater. And once Mark was there, he watched the film, and then he was going to leave. But then he told us he really wanted to know what happened next, so he stayed.
Right. What did he tell you? I mean, in a lot of ways, you uncovered so much about him. What did he make of the way you portrayed him, or the way he portrayed himself? You know what I mean?
Right. I mean, it was a tremendous relief that he responded to it. You know, I think the first thing you think about when you make a film about any one particular person is that you're respectful and that you are, truthful to who they are and what they are about. And thank goodness Mark had nothing to really, you know, get at us about. And after the film, you know, his compliments were forthcoming, and he told Mark Becker, our editor and co-director, that he did great work on the editing machine. on a second screening, Mark came on stage and answered questions along with Matt Leininger, which was quite amazing.
Wow.
And at the last question, someone asked him how he felt sort of similarly. And he Mark, as you know, as we've talked about, loves to quote films. And he said it was Mark's, he quoted Pee Wee Herman and said it was Mark's big adventure.
So let me ask you this finally, about a minute and a half left or so. Do you feel like, not that you figured him out, because he's still, I think, a mysterious guy, but do you figure in some way you got close to him, as close as you figured you could with a film like this?
I think so. I mean, I think, you know, we spent a lot of time really trying to approximate with the film the feeling we got when we spend time with Mark. And I think sort of based on his response and like how we view the film, that we got as close as we could.
Sam, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. And I what I'm most proud of is that the film that results is a film that is a testament to who Mark is, but also doesn't, you know, he did remarkable things in his life, many of which people have a lot to be upset about. Other people might find a lot of humor in, however you look at it. But what we didn't do to Mark was sort of make him sort of an object that is so different than us, because in fact, what I think you identify and what we found in him is something that is so common to all of us. You know, what he was after, what he needed in life, and what he was searching for, I think resonated with all of us. And so we maintained that while at the same time, you know, bringing out his idiosyncrasies and his uniqueness.
That's Sam Kullman, along with Jennifer Grossman and Mark Becker. They produced and directed the documentary film Art and Craft, which you can see next Wednesday. That's July 9th at 7 o'clock at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. It's part of our Through the Lens film series in partnership with the Utah Film Center. Sam and Jennifer are going to Skype with us so you can ask your own questions when you see it. For details about that, go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Sam, Jennifer, thanks very much for the time.
Thanks
for having us.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.